Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I'm Jason Snell, your co-host, and across the internet from me, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, celebrating episode 150, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hello.
Woo! Wow, that's a number there, buddy.
Yeah, it's 3 years of this thing.
Holy hell.
It's amazing that anyone is still alive.
That is, and that we've actually been on our best behavior.
Well, yeah.
For the most part. We took it on the road last week.
It's true. That was a first, I think, certainly for this configuration, a legit live episode. The old TVTM did that a couple of times, but we hadn't done that before, I think. So that was cool.
We were out there, man. We were getting it done.
Yeah. We got a couple of bits of feedback from people who couldn't hear the questions we were being asked. I was kind of waving my microphone around trying to catch everyone, but I didn't bring a third microphone, and I decided that that stuff was better even if you had a hard time hearing the question than if I had just – I could have cut it all out, but I thought the podcast was better for you to hear it. So, yeah. Anyway, you learn. I'm going to bring a third mic next time and a long cable and have next time, assuming we're ever invited anywhere ever again.
I think we're going like to all the festivals now.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll pack my bags.
We're ready to go. We're going to get like a bus.
Because they're going to be able to listen to that episode and be like, oh my, they sounded like everybody there enjoyed themselves and that it was a good time had by all.
we can pass the mic around. People asking questions.
Yes, sure. And thank you to Viff and to all of Canada, frankly, for having us.
Yes, everybody's so nice in Vancouver. I love it. I miss it, actually.
Yeah, it was nice. It was that was a pleasant few days. You stayed a little bit longer. So you did your director's panel. We should mention that you the television the era of the director. And there's a story on Hollywood Reporter that you posted that's sort of the companion to it. How did that go?
That was good. I did David Slade, who's directed the first three episodes and sort of set the template for American Gods, and he's done feature film work as well. And then next year he's gonna sort of famously direct an episode of Black Mirror. So it's gonna be interesting. He's done everything from indies to major Hollywood films. And then he did TV, and it was interesting to talk to him. He's got a deal going at Netflix, probably got a bunch of other things going. But it was fun to talk along those lines. There were a lot of people who were interested in the role of the director and the audience, as you would think from Viff. And then I did a thing called In the Writer's Room, where I talked to four different writers from different shows.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask how the writer's room... I saw the picture that you retweeted of the giant writer's room board projected behind you talking about...
Yes, from Breaking Bad. That was really good. It was good. It was fun because we had a mixture, you know. We had a mixture of... There were two... So Riverdale and Lucifer were the broadcast network variants. Mm-hmm. Simon had Ghost Wars. It was a really interesting story about behind that at Sci-Fi, which is we can sort of get into. And then we had Thomas from Breaking Bad. and of course he had that great
the photo of the cards on the corkboard.
And that really got everybody talking, because apparently in the other writers' rooms nothing is that as Simon said, nothing is ever that detailed. It was great. I had a very good time.
Yeah, that's really cool. This is the I assume that you're the same way. I've always been most fascinated with the writers part of the television making process. I know a lot of people really fan out over actors and all that. And, you know, actors are very talented and it's cool to see them and meet them. I suppose I haven't really met that many of them, but the writers I get excited by, because that's my thing. Like they're the ones, their ideas are what make these shows ultimately, you know, that's where they spring from. And so how you write for TV and how the writer's room functions, it's like really interesting stuff. So I'm glad you got to have that panel.
Yeah, and I apologize for the informality of it all. It seems like I was there. It seems like I had a microphone on me talking all the time. It seems like I was hanging out with these people and talking with you and all that. But for our people, who if we didn't mention them going into that panel, which was Saturday, Simon Davis Barry, who did Continuum,
right,
and a number of other shows, he's stepped in as you know, he didn't create Van Helsing, but he stepped in and helped out. And he did Ghost Wars, which is on Sci-Fi. And Sherry Elwood is the Sherry is the writer and executive producer of Lucifer, and she's done some. She's actually Canadian as well, and she's done some independent cable work on her own. Michael Grassi is the writer and executive producer of Riverdale. He was a very good sport because he wasn't able to make the dinner the night before. And I guess when the CW sent up the little package of a clip and it didn't play. So Michael was a great sport. Thomas is what he likes to be called. Thomas Schnoz is the writer and executive producer of Better Call Saul. And also wrote for Breaking Bad. And Tom, he's the one who brought the picture of the Better Call Saul writer's room breakdown of not only every episode, but the entire season. And they'd leave it up all week. If anybody saw a tweet, there was very funny. You could see Simon and Sherry turning around and looking at like that thing and like, wow,
what?
That is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So they were all good, and they brought different perspectives. You know, I was happy for them because, A, they were really nice people. Sherry didn't get a lot of promotion from Fox for Lucifer, and yet in its third season, the premiere episode right before our panel was their highest rated, which is great. Last night or the day before, I can't remember now, I've lost track. Riverdale opened season two to huge numbers. It was like a gigantic spike over season one. I kind of figured it would be because people kind of came to it and found it on Netflix or Hulu.
I was going to say, so my daughter, who is 15, almost 16, she found Riverdale this summer on Netflix and was so excited about it and so obsessed with it that, and this is maybe a first, maybe outside of like a reality show, last night she begged and begged and begged us to let her not finish her math homework until after she watched Riverdale because she wanted to watch it live when it aired its premiere.
Wow.
And it, again, yeah, I think when you're a parent of a kid in this age range, like you and I have, anytime they have this like sudden change in their enthusiasm about like TV consumption, you got to notice it because it's like, oh, this is what the kids are doing today. And this was like suddenly, all of a sudden, my daughter, who's supposed to be in this generation that doesn't care about TV anymore so much, right? It's all just YouTube videos and things. She wants to watch the CW at 8 to watch Riverdale on the day that it premieres. Like, she's into it. So they're doing something right with Riverdale in reaching that audience. That's pretty amazing. So, you know, and applause to Archie Comics for doing something with their brand and
it's totally different than you would ever expect. That a whole arc, you wouldn't think Archie to be what it is now, which is like murder mysteries it really did exceptionally well. And I kind of was figuring it would be because you heard a lot of buzz. People were coming to it just like your daughter did on Netflix in the summer, and you knew that was probably going to translate, but you can never quite be sure. But I'm sure the CW is pretty, pretty happy. And then, of course, Tom, Saul is not in production right now. But I'm pretty sure that we're no tears for Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad and being the main guy or being one of the main guys on those shows life is hard. He's a very, very nice person. I will say that as I left and on the 10th, so a couple days ago, Simon Davis Barry, who had his creators talk, kind of like what I did with David, was he had his creators talk about Ghost Wars, and I hope it really, really great, because he had one of those episodes that happened, which is so cringe-inducing in this peak TV era. It's kind of hard to fathom, and he handled it with such aplomb. The Sci-Fi Network, they glitched out somehow, and they didn't get any links or any advanced episodes to any critics.
Oh.
So all the work that was put in for Ghost Wars and didn't get reviewed at all. And so it's going to have to be relying on word of mouth, and people were going to have to circle back to it. And the people who did watch it are sort of like flipping out over it, and the reaction has been really great for them. It's, you know, it's a little bit of a horror story, but it's funny. It's kind of got a lot of stuff going for it. But I felt so bad for Simon that he didn't, you know, you put all that time in and then your show comes out in the most crowded time to ever have a TV show on the air in the history of television. And nobody sent out the links. That's tragic. I don't know why I'm laughing, but that's tragic.
Yeah, that's too bad, you know, to get let down. I'll tell you, from somebody who knows a lot of book writers, especially like tech books, but also some novelists, doesn't sound that surprising, right? You create something and you work hard and a lot of effort and money goes into it. And then so many times on the promotion side, you get let down.
Mm-hmm.
I can see why. This goes back to what we were saying, talking about Apple, which we have to do some follow-up on, about like how it's not just about the money. It's about like the rest, like, will it be seen? Will anyone care? Like, it kind of matters that that you don't just get the money to make the thing, but that people actually see the thing so that it can continue. Hey, there's some shows we should mention. You wrote about season 3 of Mr. Robot. I guess you've seen, so it premiered this week. We're not going to spoil anything for people. I haven't actually seen the first episode yet. You got to see the first, what, 6 episodes of this season?
Six of 10, yeah.
And, you know, season 2 was controversial. I liked it, although it's not as good as the first season. I think a lot of people felt kind of ripped off by the, you know, the latest season 2 twist in terms of what was in his head and where he actually was and all of that. Mm-hmm. A lot of people definitely felt more let down by it than I did. But your message seems to be season 3, a return to form, a reboot, almost. So that's exciting to hear.
It's fantastic because I really loved season 1 of Mr. Robot, and just going beyond, kind of just being happy it's back. I think that its fate in season 2 tells you a lot about. And I'm writing about this in a snippet of a notes column I'm doing. It tells you a lot about how difficult the world of television is. If you think about it, in the summer of 2015, Mr. Robot came out of nowhere. It created insane amount of buzz, really from word of mouth, because people hadn't seen it. It was on USA, and I don't know how much promotion there was, but it was really a dark horse candidate. It came out. People loved it. Rami Malek's performance is amazing. Sam Esmail did he revolutionized how a TV show can be shot, basically by breaking all the rules. So visually, it was stunning. The series was nominated for Best Drama in its freshman series. Rami Malek was nominated for Lead Actor. And they had a writing, I think they had a writing or a directing nomination as well. And Rami Malek won. And there was all this buzz. They go into the second season and it just disappears. And so by the time this current iteration of the Emmys came by, which was just recently, right?
Yeah.
So in September, when we had the Emmys just last month, there was like no one talking about it. No one predicted that the show would do anything. It didn't get as many nominations. It was basically forgotten. And it's, I think that's a cautionary tale about what can happen if you slip up even the slightest bit, because buzz, all of that stuff kind of matters. And, you know, I thought the second season was fine, but it was definitely a letdown from the first. And it actually is one of those rare instances people have asked me, should I just skip it and go to the third? I think you could actually skip it because they kind of don't circle back to anything important in the second season so much. But the third season is, and I think that the big conceit of the second season, because, you know, there's always a lot going on in the series without giving anything away. The big conceit of the second season, once it was revealed, people were like, huh, yeah, that's interesting. But it was not kind of on par with the first season. And more importantly, sure. Sam Esmail was trying to broaden all the stuff out. You had a lot more minor characters getting a lot more screen time. And you moved away from the Elliot and Mr. Robot storylines a little bit, you know, and so you kind of he got kind of sidelined a little bit as they expanded out to the rest of the cast, which you have to do. But there was so much emphasis on that, I think it got a little bit boring and slow for other people. I'm here to say that as of Wednesday, when it returned, people can catch up on it. Definitely catch up on it, because not only does it come back super strong, it's really smart. It's very funny. It is totally meta in that it knows that its season one conceit, which I will also not spoil, is kind of hard to explain and kind of hard to justify in its third season. And so they kind of talk about how difficult it is, which I thought was nice. It comes out of the gate on fire. And I love the fact how he retroactively answered a lot of people's questions from the first two seasons by showing you backstory in the third season. And he goes through it quickly, and I loved it. And I know that some people have struggled with the character Tyrell Wellick. I'm here to tell you he's so much better this season, but he's in at least two episodes where you're like, I love this this guy. Huh. And I love this change of direction. And he was one of my least favorite characters, and I thought that was great. But beyond that, it's just it goes really fast. It corrects a lot of things that you might consider wrongs from the past, and then it's smart, it's funny, and I think it careens through the first six that I watched at a pretty amazing pace.
Can't wait to dig into it. It was, it was big night on our TiVo last night because You're the Worst was also on. So it's like those two shows are on at the same time. It's like a Wednesday night party.
Yeah, it's
I know,
it's hard to catch
so much
up
TV,
everything.
So much, mm-hmm. so much. Should we talk about Netflix and the cracks beginning to show?
Sure, let's do that.
That's another piece you wrote is the Critics Notebook, which is like, what is going on with Netflix? So what is it? What's happening?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I was working on this story in my mind for a while because I've been getting a lot of feedback. I think it goes back to a column in 2015 or no, late 2016, where I wrote about Amazon's strategy or lack thereof. And when people make their shows and then they get put on Amazon, and you and I have already talked about this. I think we may have even done it on the podcast where, you know, if the show gets up and you can't even tell that's even made, and they weren't Amazon was not, I think, correctly identifying their Amazon originals and separating them from just stuff that they bought. Never mind the fact that some people are paying for Amazon Prime and not figuring out that they get video. So they had a lot of stuff that they were working on, and I got a lot of feedback from people and complaints, and I wrote about it. And got more complaints for people who were like, yeah, thank God you wrote that. But then I started to get some from Netflix. And the gist is very similar. It is, and it's this. And it comes down to a relationship with people. And I think that is something that they're not going to... I mean, we can talk about strategy and, you know, debt and spending. And will Apple have an impact on them? All those kind of things are certainly legit business stories. But from an actual... interpersonal communication with other creators, the problem that I'm seeing or I'm hearing from other people is that, okay, so Jason makes a show for Netflix and they give Jason a shit ton of money. He's very happy about that.
He makes
10, check the box, of course. So he makes 10 episodes yep. And, you know, it's a new show. So he gets a little bit of publicity, not a great lot, but he gets some, he gets a couple of some reviews in advance. Even though there's a ton of Netflix product coming out, you get a bunch of reviews. People really love your show, Jason, and you're like, woo, excited. And then all 10 episodes drop, and you are never talked to again, basically.
Yep, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And so that, it, you know...
If I'm really lucky, mm-hmm. about 5 weeks later, somebody somewhere tweets about how they liked my thing, and then a little bit of buzz builds. But for every, like, Making a Murder that happened, Stranger Things that happened for, I mean, you can talk about, you know which ones there are. There aren't that many. Generally, it's just sort of like, boom, and then it's gone.
Exactly. And, well, I mean, certainly that what you just said about the 5 weeks later speaks to my big push within THR and in the industry that we as critics need to circle back and invest longer and deeper analysis in shows that we finish rather than start and sometimes ignore entirely. But yes, so in that scenario, you got your money, but you didn't get your premiere. And that's important to a lot of people. And then once your show came out, because of the binge necessity, it all comes out at the same time. Then no one really talks to you after that. And you're not supposed to complain about it because we gave you some money. And so you had a critically acclaimed show. They don't talk about ratings. But then the next season, and they're going to give you a shit ton of money again. And then you're going to make another show. But this time, you might not get as much press as you got the first time. And beyond that, once the show appears, it might be hard to find it inside, shockingly, inside the world of Netflix, because they have so much content. And how does it gurgle up in the algorithm? How do people who are searching for, say, they've never seen Stranger Things, how is that person or that family going to see an ad, quote unquote, inside of Netflix for their own content, which would be your show? It doesn't happen that often. And so you get this thing where people feel like, yeah, you gave me the money and I really love it, but I also love the shows that I created. I love the content that I created, and I feel like it's not being nurtured and I feel forgotten. And that is why I said there's cracks in there, because if that happens, then at some point, using you as an example, you say, you know what? I think two seasons was enough. I'm going to go to another place and do my show at FX, or a different show at FX, or, because they're telling me that they're going to handhold with me and give me a premiere, etc.
Yeah, FX or HBO or AMC or some place that is going to roll it out weekly, and it's going to do a publicity blitz, and I'm going to have bloggers who are going to be recapping it week by week instead of writing one article about it. I was noticing that about watching Star Trek Discovery, which I am enjoying, by the way. I think it's really good. I think it's a departure from Star Trek, and yet it also has a lot of the things that make me love Star Trek, and I think they're doing a really good job. It's got issues, but I watch it like carefully and enjoy the whole thing, and I'm very sad when it's over, and that's always a really good sign. But those are weekly. They're doing the thing like Hulu has done, where they're dropping episodes weekly, and, you know, what do they get out of it? The New York Times writes a recap every single week about Star Trek Discovery. I mean, that's free publicity for CBS All Access when they do that. And there are a bunch of other sites doing that. And every time I see one of those, I think, this is why if I were a creator, I would be super frustrated at being at one of these places that just drops all of my episodes at once and walks away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Netflix is never going to change that strategy.
No, it's part of their brand, right? I mean, at this point, I have a hard time. I mean, you can see what they do, which is, I guess Star Trek, they're actually rolling it out week by week. But a lot of, in the U.S., what they tend to do is wait for the binge. Like Travelers, that show that I discovered last year, is coming on in Canada next week. But it's not going to be on in the U.S. and Netflix until December, because they want all the episodes to queue up so they can drop them in a block instead of just rolling them out one a week like they are in Canada, which they could do, because they do that with some shows overseas that have got picked up the rights from the U.S. But, you know, it's not their preference. And I guess it works for them. But, you know, your point here, I think, is that it doesn't necessarily work for some of their partners, which could lead to trouble for them down the road, right? Because theoretically, I mean, I know if they've got money, they're going to find somebody to give the money to, but the risk there is that they're going to lose the best people to their competitors, right?
Yeah, it's a problem. And, it's early days and people do like money, but I'm, you know, if there's ever going to be, I mean, there are bigger battles ahead for Netflix for against other competition, but the little cracks are the ones I think that are going to cause the most amount of trouble. And so that one, let's see what happens if they can maybe fix that that little problem with their personal relations.
Yeah, Interesting. Some other shows we should talk about. Dirk Gently season 2 is coming back. I know you liked season 1. Have you gotten a chance to watch any of season 2 yet?
Of Dirk Gently, I'm reviewing that now. I had just about to start it. I couldn't get my access yesterday, so I didn't do it. So it'll actually, my review will go Friday, which was our normal worldwide release.
Yes.
And you'll have information you can that you'll ever want on Dirk Gently. But I'm sorry, I did get a little bit, because it's not a Columbo, but I did kind of bury the lead for you.
Okay.
For a story that happened, and you just tripped it in my brain when you talked about Travelers.
All right, we're just going to make that U-turn. Now we're just, I got to back the truck up first. Beep, 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 beep. All right, now back in front gear, making the U-turn, going back. All right, the podcast truck has returned. What a Columbo me.
Okay.
So, this is a big podcast, Tim. There's 150 episodes. It's so large, we have to have the little beep sound go when we back
do.
Up.
We do. Yeah. So I had dinner with Simon Bear and his lovely wife, who's also a director and a cinematographer, and writes series. And they were having another guest over, who also is a director. And so I walked over. I brought my wine over in lovely Vancouver. And it's somebody that you would know, apparently. I found this out. And when I found it out, I said, oh, it's too bad that my podcast partner Jason's not here, because he would have known as soon as the door opened and we walked in. Whereas I am just like, wait, you were on a TV show? So anyway, you probably know one of your favorite shows, Stargate.
It's Amanda Tapping. You met Amanda Tapping, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Because she's a director now. She also appears occasionally, but she directs a lot of stuff up in Vancouver.
Yeah, and she directs the Travelers. And
yes, she did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things where I just have to say, you know what? I apologize, because she was totally didn't care at all, obviously, but and wonderful person and a great, great time talking to her. But like, just literally not at all familiar with Stargate. And I think Simon and his wife were hilariously making fun of me for that. But
it's a huge, like, wow, huge. Oh yeah, I would have died. I would have died. That would have been hilarious. Yeah, she's
Amanda.
Great.
She's lovely.
And she does what that. I feel like that's such a smart move for actors to say, like, okay, I'm a star of a show and it's been on for a while. Let me direct some episodes. And it's like, then she builds that up, and then she's, and then she knows the producers, and they move on to other shows and they hire her to direct episodes of their shows. And before you know it, she's a director. It's pretty great. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the way to do it. And I think she seems really happy doing it, which is great.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But Travelers. Is what, yeah, it's what tricked
that,
me out.
That did it, because yes, she is. Well, that's a Stargate producer who is the producer behind Brad Wright, I think, one of the original showrunners of Stargate, mm-hmm. and he's the showrunner for Travelers. Well, that was good. That was worth backing the truck up for.
Oh, I thought you would like that. Yeah. And it's funny, because I just kind of kept it, and I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, wow. Okay, but she's a lovely woman, and a great, separately, no one will care. A great time that night, drinking wine and talking about the television industry with stories I cannot share.
Simon, I was in an elevator with Simon Barry, and I didn't say anything, because I was like, this is going to be weird, because he doesn't need a guy in an elevator to say, hey, I like Continuum. So I didn't say it.
Oh, he would have loved it. He would have loved it. He's also super down to earth. I always like when I meet the super down to earth guys. And I got to share a joke with him, because since I know him, I can't review Ghost Wars, but it turned out that would not have mattered anyway, because by the time I left, who knew? I thought we were just going to handle it, but he's like, oh no, no one got it.
There's no screeners. It's not a problem.
There are no screeners.
Yay. Anyway, hooray. Yeah,
there we go.
So nice. So nice. All right. So Dirk Gently season 2, screener issues there. Going to do it. Mindhunter, you're not reviewing it, right? Because it premiered at Comic-Con, but that's the David Fincher show that's premiering.
Big one on Netflix. That's not a shocker, because so many things are coming out. I'm excited to look. It's just to backtrack quickly on the Dirk Gently thing.
Beep. All right. Okay. All right. We're back to Dirk Gently.
Oh,
it's like everything, every topic in this. I introduce the next topic, then we discuss. This could be a format for a show. It's the previous topic podcast where I introduce
previously
a topic
on,
and we move it back to the previous topic. But we like it's like the on Pardon the Interruption. They got the like what's going to come next. It's like it's just, you know, oh, what's he going to say about Mindhunter? Well, wait while we talk about Dirk Gently now.
Well, I just wanted to say because I was thinking about Travelers when you were talking about that, and I was my brain scattered. Is that I actually feel a connection to this story, to this little show, because I did love season one. I loved reviewing it. I'm not a whole lot of people did. And I'm excited for season two. It's just one of those shows on BBC America, which is still on their old strategy of running things on Saturdays, which I think is maybe works these days. Who knows?
It's BBC night.
It's BBC night. And I love it. And I just think that there's so much fun in that little show and there's so much creativity going on there. To me, it's another example of like when I'm in the bubble and I'm watching a show like that, I'm like, oh, guess what? No one's really watching this. And I'm happy that I'm actually just taking a little time and trying to put in some effort on this one, because if you can spotlight shows like that, great. There's it's so hard to get a show of any kind to get noticed unless it's enormous. So, and on Twitter, I've noticed that my rambling about Dirk Gently and talking about it on the podcast has got some people excited for the return. Unfortunately, I haven't reviewed it yet, but I will before it comes on and you can read it. But I'm just saying thank you to everybody who appreciates like either watching a show that's kind of small or reading a little bit about it before they do.
Okay. I want to talk about Apple. So Mindhunter, David Fincher, premieres on Netflix on Friday. Sorry, I was just doing the thing that we do now where I mention the next topic.
I know, yeah.
And we don't know, I mean, but it was a Comic-Con premiere, right? So you didn't have to review it. So it's just, but it's high profile and everybody will be talking about it on Saturday and then they'll stop talking about it because probably.
They'll stop talking about it because all the episodes will have dropped.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that'll be it. Sorry, David Fincher. Good luck.
But that, you know, it was his decision to, he had put the embargo until a day before it premiered, which gives you no press.
Right.
And then everybody was annoyed. And then at the last second, Netflix, which I kind of also mentioned in my Netflix column, just said, oh, by the way, we just secured it to go to New York Comic Con a couple of days earlier, which made us like take the review out of my hands and move it to New York for somebody who was going to be there. So all I got to say is, man, that show better be pretty good, because when I circle back around and say, I finally get to watch this, you better pay off, because expectations are high now about that secrecy.
Yeah, exactly. So, Apple. Also, we got some tweets. That'll be next. But Apple, okay. We said, in fact, we looked really good this week, I got to say, you and I.
Yeah.
Because once again, we said what we've been saying for a little while. We did last week about how, mark our words, Apple will start making these high-profile deals, and people will be like, what? Apple signed so-and-so? And so it was Steven Spielberg.
That's
a pretty good name. And, you know, in reality, it's Amblin Entertainment and Universal are the ones who made Amazing Stories back in the 80s, and they've been shopping a revival of it, and it sounds like they got Brian Fuller on board to run it, which,
really,
you know, it's an anthology show, so show running an anthology show is probably a little bit different than, it's probably about corralling some good scripts more than anything else, I would think, because it's not like you have to set an arc or anything. But I think it's, they got him involved, and this is the announcement is that's going to be that 10 episode first season of a revived Amazing Stories got bought by Apple, and this is Apple after Apple bid on and failed to get the Ryan Murphy show that they bid on. But here's that story. And so we, you know, again, there's going to be more. I mean, this is, if they've got $1 billion to spend and this is a $50 million deal ish, then. Yeah. Just do the math. It's. I wrote two pieces this week about this because the Spielberg news broke. I probably wrote 3,000 words about this. Most of those words will not be a surprise to TV Talk Machine listeners because we've been talking about it here. But the idea that they've got the money to spend and they're not gonna go buy 20 shows, but like HBO at any given time has what between like a dozen and maybe 20 active original series at any one time, and you know, so. Is it unrealistic to think that Apple would try to get to a point, maybe even a little bit below that, and then still have some money left over to buy a catalog of stuff, whether it's movies or TV shows or both. Like, for $1 billion, there's a lot of stuff you can do. And here's Exhibit A. They're going to be way more. It's not, they're not all going to be like this one, but, you know, we got those headlines, which was Steven Spielberg signs with Apple to do a TV show. And that's what we said would happen. I wouldn't have picked him in a draft of potentials.
I was a little surprised by
but
that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about that, it was, I think you, I read your stuff, and also, like, when you saying, like, you know, it's Amblin and it's this other stuff. Here's the thing. Steven Spielberg's no fool. He's going to look at that money and with the way they treat him, and he's going to say, yeah, I got some other ideas. So being in business with him is a win-win no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely. It gives them some cred, right? And that's what they're looking for. They got the executives give them some cred, that they're making deals gives them some cred. And that's what they need, because they're otherwise it's just like Apple. Mm-hmm. I love your iPhone. Why would I make a TV show for you? So
yeah.
The mystery still remains about what the service will be. There was a lot. I wrote a whole piece that people can find on Six Colors about. I'll put a link in the show notes too.
Yeah, put the link in
about
there.
Yeah, so you can see it. But it's like burning questions about this service and what it might be. And really, there's a question of, like, do they roll it in with Apple Music and just make it this one service? And I think that's less likely. I think it's more likely that they will ask people for more money. And although they bundle it together, no idea what they're going to name it. I hope they get their crack naming experts on it. I actually think Apple TV might be the best name for it, even though it's already the name of the box. And
I know, right?
And in talking to people who cover Apple a lot, I am coming around to the argument that Apple will not let this be on any box but their own. That'll be part of the deal is, like, you know, buy an Apple TV and you'll get 3 months trial for free, but it's on Apple TV. And if you want to watch this show, you're going to need to buy an Apple TV to get it, especially if they call it Apple TV, which maybe they should. That's actually not a bad name. I thought, I realized that another great name for this service would be Apple Watch. And I thought, oh no, they have that one already. They did that.
Apple Watch, Apple TV.
It's very confusing. So, and then the Hulu question hovers out there, which I know that you're kind of enamored of that theory. And, you know, when I look at it, I feel like hiring the executives suggests that maybe they've decided not to buy something. But
right.
I did find an interesting piece that I linked to in my piece, which is somebody speculating that would Hulu be better off with a single owner? And it was a good point that, you know, Hulu's owners are essentially ABC, NBC, Fox, and Time Warner.
Mm-hmm. And two of those got a streaming service.
yeah. Well, I mean, and they're all going to be looking at streaming services. So none of them are particularly, I think, enthusiastic about Hulu. Hulu's more like a frenemy for them. And right. And Hulu can't make moves that it maybe should make because it doesn't want to offend the networks. So we end up in this middle ground. So I think it's intriguing, and that Apple might actually be a great owner of that to just buy it and turn it into Apple TV, but I doubt it'll happen. But it's an interesting idea. They've got the money to do it, but it would be their biggest acquisition by far, because Hulu is worth like $25 billion.
Yeah, it's a big one, and I don't think it's going to happen either. But it's so old school TVTM to say it, but it wouldn't surprise me if it did, because it's a good target, and beyond just needing one owner, it has, like, the fact that people are going to want to sort of get out of that and move on into their own areas. But maybe in the meantime, while they're building it and seeing how it works, meaning their streaming services and their platform, it might not be a bad idea to still be hedging your bets a little bit by having your shows on Hulu, which is fully established. And there's a lot of things that are really interesting about that. Again, I don't think it'll, part of me doesn't think it'll happen because, and I know I got hung up on this in my own brain. It's like Hulu is such a well-established name. You wouldn't want to change it, but Apple seems like they would want to change it if they bought it.
Yeah, I think they would. I think they almost certainly, just like with Beats, which was less established, but still they took Beats Music and they're like, this is nice. And then it was Apple Music and that was the end of it. So maybe so. I guess we'll just keep watching and waiting, but it's out there. And I'm just saying, if you're listening to the TVTM simultaneously worldwide, then you were not surprised. How about that? You were informed. You knew this was a thing that was going to happen. I got a couple of tweets to read.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I'll read those. Jason Barry wrote in to say, I really enjoyed the Live from VIF episode. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Impressed by your predictive powers the day days before the Apple Spielberg announcement. Yeah, that's us. That's us. We're going to take a little, we're going to pat ourselves on the back for that one.
Mm-hmm.
Has to be done every now and then. We're going to take a victory lap. And Dean of the 707, traveling Dean, asked, and this is interesting. I want to know what your take on it is, which is, what's up with the late night comics and especially SNL ignoring the Harvey Weinstein story this week? And Norm Michael said it's a New York thing. I mean, I responded to Dean on Twitter, and what I said was, I think there's fear from people in the entertainment industry that this is inside baseball, that knowing who movie producers are is not something that the mainstream audience does. But do you buy that? Do you think that's the reason?
Well, I'm not entirely, because I do think that, and it's been sort of covered now by others, but I do think that it certainly seems like there might have been an internal NBC memo about like how to handle this, because they, you know, they're the ones who turned down the Ronan Farrow interview.
Yeah,
which
exactly
was
right.
Lock solid, and the New Yorker, which, you know, vets things very strongly, was fine with it.
And having worked in big corporation before, I can tell you, sometimes you may have experienced this too. Sometimes it's not a corporate policy set by like major executives or saying, you know, here's what our standards are journalistically. Sometimes it is a lawyer in the legal department who is afraid of being sued and will just err on the side of saying, no, don't do it. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times it's their job to protect the company, but a lot of times they will make, they'll be really risk averse. They'll be like, no, don't take any chances. And I wonder if that was part of it too. There's just fear, right? Because he's famed for suing everybody. He threatened the New York Times last week, even mm-hmm. while admitting that it was basically true, which is just amazing.
It's just, he's all over the map on that. But as he's going down, it's a fascinating story. Sad, and as not because he's going, obviously, but sad because it happened to all these women, and the ripples and repercussions are so much greater than people thought, as more people come out and say that they were victims. I think the repercussion of that is really interesting, because I think it does have a chance to actively change the industry, where it's just like, we brought down one of the biggest people in the industry, and women are saying, hey, this dude is not alone.
Yeah.
This is not a lone wolf. This behavior is endemic to this system, and like, we're not going to tolerate it anymore. And I think that's how you create change. And so I think we'll see more of that. Certainly a lot of sites, but obviously THR and the industry based sites or entertainment sites are all over it going forward. But yeah, I wonder if there was like a chilling effect. It certainly does seem odd that NBC went out of their way to pass on that story, and then you didn't hear any NBC properties talk about it, not just from SNL, but even in the morning show.
Yeah, I wonder if a little bit of it, just trying to put my mind in SNL's, that if. My understanding was they had some material and they cut it at the dress rehearsal. And I wonder if their feeling was like, it just wasn't funny. And I don't know whether that means the material was bad or whether whether somebody was like, this is actually really awful. And is this something we want to joke about right now when people are coming out talking about a famous person being a serial sex offender who was being sheltered by his industry?
Right.
I don't know. I mean, everything I suppose is fodder for comedy, but you throw that in the pot. There's a lot of things it could have been. I did like, there was somebody who I think works with or is closely allied with the Trump administration, tweeted at Samantha Bee, basically saying, it's funny that you haven't said anything about this. And her response was, it's funny that you forgot we're on Wednesday nights. I don't know if she actually did a thing about it, but the thing about last night, but I think about Samantha Bee's show is, Samantha Bee's show is funny, but it's also angry, and it is about women's issues a lot of the time. And that seems like a better fit than getting this addressed with a stand-up by Samantha Bee. Seems much better fit, or any late-night comedian, frankly, but certainly her, than working it into a sketch, right? That seems like that might be a harder way to find comedy But I don't know. Certainly fear has got to be a part of it, right?
I think so, too.
Yeah. I mean,
and last
even now, even with him deposed, it's still he's still dangerous, right?
Yeah.
More dangerous, maybe? I don't know.
I would just say that not running a skit because it's not funny is doesn't really hold up with SNL because SNL.
Okay, you got me there. You got me there. Okay. That was solid. Solid.
Thank you. I just had to wait on that because you know how much I dislike SNL. So there you go.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. You make a strong point. Okay, let's wrap it up with a nemesis question. It is from Alan in the 415, one of my nemeses.
Hello, Alan.
Oh, hello, Alan. And Alan says, is it time to give up on the Orville yet? I'm going to take this one, Tim. I'm going to take this one.
Okay, you got this. All right.
I got it. Is it time to give up on the Orville yet? I've still only watched the first two. Because the third episode is apparently kind of problematic, we'll say. I think I've given up on the Orville only because as much as I like Star Trek The Next Generation, I saw it 90 years ago. I saw it 30 years ago when it was on. And I don't need to see a 30 years later nostalgic rehash of it, which is kind of what the Orville strikes me as being right now. If it's comfort food for you, then great, but I can't watch one of those without getting the Seth MacFarlane jokes in it, and I don't think he's particularly funny most of the time. And I don't need more bro humor in my sci-fi. And then I look at Star Trek Discovery and I think, yeah, this is the show that I want to watch. So
right.
I say yes, give up, but if it makes you happy, keep watching it, whatever.
Wow.
But I said give up.
Solid.
I gave up.
And that's good advice because you're ahead of me on that. I haven't seen it yet, so you're ahead of me.
There's nothing. I mean, seriously. Yeah. Homage to Star Trek The Next Generation. That's what it is, basically, with some fart jokes. Wow. Because it's Seth MacFarlane, right? So there's like dick jokes and fart jokes.
Yeah, it's troubling.
Imagine if Captain Picard complained about his hemorrhoids while sitting in the captain's chair of the Enterprise. He got the Orville at that point.
Yeah.
Wow. Do you want to see that? Well, maybe not.
Well, I think that circles back to my Dirk Gently Holistic Beep. Detective Agency story, Beep. Which is Beep. Why Beep. Why not watch Beep. Something you haven't watched and you might like, rather than something that is made by a gigantic corporation and will be there in front of
actually,
you.
Actually, in that vein, I'm going to say The Flash and all the other CW superhero shows premiered this week.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't watch any of them.
Ooh, that's a little troubling.
Well, The Flash was so bad last year that I think I'm just gonna not watch it and use my time more wisely. Although I saw the trailer for Legends of Tomorrow, of all things, which was a terrible show its first season,
right,
and it made me laugh like five times. It made me laugh out loud, and I thought, oh, maybe they seem to have realized how ridiculous their show is and that the only way it's good is if it's funny and lighthearted, and great, I might actually tune in for that. They may have turned that one around, but The Flash, it's like, I don't know if I want to take that. I've seen that ride. I took that ride 2 years in a row where they did the same things and it was really bad. So it makes me sad because that was serious comfort TV. And I think I'm off the train. I have one other random thing to mention. Boy, I'm really Columboing it here at the end.
You just Columboed yourself right there.
I did, which is hard to do. Let me tell you got to work at it. You got to stretch.
Yeah. Hard to pull off self-Columbo.
So coming out next month is The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is Amy Sherman-Palladino's new show on Amazon. They got a premiere date and got a trailer this week. And I mention this only because I think I totally missed that this was being made. I didn't know what the premise was. I knew nothing about it. Watched the pilot this week. I thought it was great. I thought it was really good. So I don't even want to spoil what it's about, because if you don't know, just if you've got Amazon Prime, you can just go watch the pilot now and it's there, and don't spoil yourself on the premise. Because it's kind of a good thing, but I really liked it. So I don't know. That's something to watch for, next month. That's a thing I saw and I finally finished, Master of None season two. And that is a legitimately great show, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. It's really great. It's heartwarming and funny and real. Love it.
Yeah. And so many, I was sitting there. I mean, having finally watched the Thanksgiving episode, which won all the awards, It's so good. Like that show is, it is delightful and good. And you know, a lot of really the best shows on TV, a lot of them are hard work and mm-hmm. not always the easiest material, right? They're a little less accessible and maybe a little unpleasant. Handmaid's Tale is a great example, the best drama winner, right? Like that's really a hard show to watch. We should talk about that in a future episode because
yes.
I confessed mm-hmm. to you last week that off the air that I have given up on it because it's so dark and I just can't take it. And then there's Master of None, which is like, it deals with real serious issues and yet it's just wonderful and enjoyable and warm and you want to hug it. So
yeah,
that's a trick.
That's exactly,
neat trick.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
All right. I think that'll do it for this week, but please write to us. We didn't have a lot of letters this week. So podcast@tvtalkmachine.com. You can tweet at us @TVTM. Those are the best ways to reach us. There's also the Facebook page, facebook.com/TVTalkmachine. And sometimes we post there and sometimes we don't. Our nemesis control the Facebook page right now. That's fine. They can do that. And but we'll be back next week. Until then, Tim, pleasure as always.
Always, and we'll see you next week.
We've got to back up the truck now. Bye, everybody. Beep. Beep.